Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
But still dangerous Al-Qaeda network, and the president once again notes that what he calls the war on terror will be a long war. With 2 months to go before midterm congressional elections, Democrats have their own take today, claiming that America is left safe now because of failed Republican policies. John Diamond covers security and intelligence issues for USA Today. He joins us now. And John, what do you make of this? What jumps out at you?
Yes, well, I think that it's there are no radical changes in the strategy. There seems to be an effort to clarify the message. There is a long-term strategy, which is promote democracy, which sees the war on terror as something akin to the Cold War, a rather long ideological struggle against a movement that purports to offer something totally different than Western-style capitalism and democracy.
It's what the report calls a battle of ideas. Quick question there. What does that say to you about, for instance, U.S. policy towards Iran or North Korea?
Well, this has been a terribly problematic area for the United States, particularly with its longstanding support for Israel. This is a universally accepted policy across both parties in the U.S., but it is a constant thorn in the side of policymakers in terms of the message being sent to the Middle East. And it's very difficult to win the battle of ideas when American weapons are being used in the Arab-Israeli wars. So the United States, in terms of selling its strategy, has a tough road to hoe there.
Well, it would seem to send the message to Iran that, you know, the U.S. would be looking for a regime change, a democratic government.
That's right. I mean, the policy certainly says, on the one hand, that it will stay very aggressive. The president's language, it's almost Churchillian in terms of, sort of never surrender, never give in to terrorists, and to hold states equally responsible to the terrorists when those states sponsor terror groups. I found it interesting that this strategy, although we don't think of the war on terror as a territorial war, this strategy puts a great emphasis on territory. In other words, preventing state support for terror groups, preventing terrorists from getting control of weak states or areas like Afghanistan or Western Pakistan, preventing terrorists from moving across borders. Mm-hmm. It's very much a geographic and physical territorial war, as seen by the White House.
Well, and the strategy paper lists Afghanistan along with Iraq as successes. Yet today's New York Times points out in a lengthy story from Afghanistan how that country has become statistically as dangerous for U.S. troops as Iraq.
Yes, it is. And I think that most neutral analysts would put a big question mark over Afghanistan and not put it in cleanly in the success story category. We saw in the Soviet era with the invasion of Afghanistan that the Soviets had little trouble toppling the regime that they opposed. They imposed regime change in Afghanistan, as we did. But then they had nearly a decade of increasing trouble there. It's a very difficult place for conventional armies to fight, and we're encountering similar difficulties.
Well, John Diamond, another line jumped out at us in the minute or so we have. It was the one that said that, our effective counter-terrorist efforts in part have forced the terrorists to evolve and modify their ways of doing business. Some might take that as not a claim to victory. I mean, evolve is a word we see as grow.
It's a fairly soft statement when you put it next to the sort of, we will capture and kill them, we will hunt them to the ends of the earth language that we've heard from the president and the vice president in past years. It's a fairly, a measured statement. Politically, the White House problem is to both claim progress in the war on terror, but also continue to underscore that there is a problem that remains which they feel they are best suited to solve. So they're certainly not inclined to claim total victory. I think, though, that we saw in the London situation a localized terror group that was struggling to design a terror attack that was viable. I mean, that was a serious and scary plot, but it's not clear to the experts that they really could have brought airplanes down with the scheme that they had developed to bring these small bombs on board aircraft. And that may be one example of the way in which terror groups that have become localized and separated from Al-Qaeda with its expertise and training facilities, that may be one example of where this evolution has indeed weakened terror groups.
John Diamond, Washington-based correspondent for USA Today. John, thanks as always.
Okay, Robin.
Well, the New York Times also says today that Republicans in Congress will focus on security measures in the weeks leading up to November's midterm elections, and that immigration policy might be set aside for the time being because Republicans feel that issue would reveal too many divisions within the party. Not too long ago, immigration reform was a presidential priority. President Bush made it the topic of a primetime address. But journalist and veteran border watcher Chuck Boden says that was all just talk. He says, like global warming, illegal immigration has become a force beyond the reach of American power or imagination. Boden drove 7,000 miles to survey the massive migration that brings thousands of Mexicans into the U.S. illegally every year. The results of that trip are in an article in the September-October issue of Mother Jones magazine. And by the way, the written images in the story are stunning, but there are also photographs taken by Julian Cardona, and you can see them going to our website, here-now.org. And Chuck Boden joins us from his home in Tucson, Arizona, with more. Chuck, tell us your overarching thoughts on immigration so we know where we are. Who's to blame? What side are you on?
I'm not on any side, but here's the problem. Both governments, the Mexican government and the United States government, lie about it. The migration is far larger than either government will acknowledge. It's at least 1 million people a year. It's being economically driven, not by what your listeners have been told, a bunch of Mexicans that just want to get rich in the United States. This is a flight of the poor from a collapsing economy. So it's essentially unstoppable.
So
the third thing is these bills in Congress are irrelevant. You know, if you want the McCain-Kennedy bill with guest worker permits, fine. There's 12 million here already. How many are you going to print? If you want to build a wall, fine. Then Mexico will explode because there's no, you know, there's no work.
And so are you saying that the government of Mexico and behind that Honduras and Guatemala, you're saying they're to blame?
No, look, the government of Mexico would collapse if it didn't export its poor. The government of Mexico in November of 2001 issued a study that no one in the media here ignored where they said if the Mexican economy performed at its most optimum level for 30 years, they would export 15 million people to the United States just to survive. The other thing your listeners have to know is that the remittances, the money the illegal Mexicans that are working in the United States send home, is far in excess of what Mexico earns from tourism, its second largest industry. It's over $20 billion a year. Without that money, the country would go down the sewer.
Because, as you point out in your article, Mexico has already exported most of its jobs to places like China.
NAFTA came in, we're going to build factories, et cetera, et cetera, you know, the maquiladoras. Hundreds of thousands of those jobs have gone to China in the last 4 or 5 years for the simple reason that the Chinese will work for one-fourth the wages of a Mexican. So those jobs have vanished. Now, I don't want to go into 500 years of history in a sort of blame game, but here's the deal. You've got a country you share a 2,000-mile border with that has surplus population and a sinking economy, and they're coming north, and they're going to continue to come north. The only decision we get to make is how we react to that.
And just so people know, you're not buying into the usual defense of Mexicans coming into the country because you knock down some of what you say are the cards that people cut to fit their ideology. For instance, you say Mexicans coming north do take jobs.
Of course they take jobs. They're all gainfully employed here because they're really not eligible for welfare. Of course they drive down wages. That's their only asset. You have people that don't know English, have limited education. Their asset is they'll work for less. I'm not blaming them for that.
You write to those who say they don't drive down wages. Surely there is a Nobel Prize to be earned in studying this remarkable exception to the law of supply and demand.
The other thing that drives me crazy is, like, I know the Minutemen and those people. I've hung out with them. This idea that somehow this Homeland Security is involved, like Al-Qaeda is going to come here sneaking through Mexico. If an Islamic terrorist landed in Mexico, they'd be on a barbecue grill in 10 minutes. I mean, this is not a user-friendly country for those people. It's just nonsense. The people coming north, for regardless of what your listeners think of them, are simply hardworking, honest, working people trying to survive. That's why they're coming.
And let's talk about some of them, because you met them in the middle of the night. Describe some of these passages that you witnessed along the border. I mean, I thought it was astonishing we just don't remember this, that it's for instance, so dark that a huge group of people passing 50 yards from you, you wouldn't see.
Yeah, so you can't see anything out there. There's no illumination. It's an unpopulated desert. Now, when I was a younger man, to try and dramatize this issue, I went to Mexico, hooked up with 20, 30 Mexicans, crossed illegally, walked 45 miles in one night across the desert in June, and it damn near killed me. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done physically. But this is a horrendous thing they're going through. You know, they're stumbling around in the dark in a desert that's 100 degrees, it's full of cactus. They only have a gallon of water. They always run out of water. And this summer, I will guarantee several hundred of them will die in the desert from heat prostration. Mm. I'm living in a kind of unofficial cemetery here.
You met children in particular, young people, who were so, you know, barely surviving this, that they were trying to turn themselves in.
Three times in doing this story, I ran into young Mexican kids, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, who had been lost in the desert for days, were terrified, and just wanted me to turn them into the Border Patrol, you know, so they didn't die. And, you know, I'd give them money and water, and two of them I drove back to the border, which almost got me arrested.
Because it's illegal.
Good heavens, the girl was, I think, 18, the boy 16 or something, you know, they were little, very small people from Oaxaca, basically Indians. They'd been out there for 4 days, wandering, and I had garbage in the back of my truck. I'd picked up the litter illegals throw away as they walk, mm-hmm. and they just dove into it. They were so thirsty and hungry. They would have eventually been picked up, and then I'll tell you what will happen. The U.S. government will take them back to where they started, you know, give them a free ride to the border, and then they'll go through the wire again that night. Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at one picture that accompanied your article. Again, they're at our website, here-now.org. It's of just, as far as the eye can see, debris, backpacks, water bottles. What is that?
It's a dump site. You cross the border. You've paid money. You have a guide. You stumble around for 2 or 3 days. And then you finally get to like a dirt road that comes off a paved road. There'll be a van waiting there. You know, the coyote. That you paid for.
The coyote.
That guy will have clothes so you'll look like an American, because when you're going north, you've got a day pack and a bunch of black clothing in the hopes you'll be less visible at night. And so you will strip naked very fast, everything. Change clothes, jump in the van, and go to the stash house in Tucson or Phoenix. That photograph is of hundreds of acres of day packs, underwear, clothing, where these people have, like, transmuted themselves from illegal Mexicans into a facsimile of an American. You know, they get the clothes at Kmart. You know, they'll give them football jerseys that say Oakland Raiders and things. And it's kind of haunting, because what you're looking at is the unofficial Ellis Island. This is where the new Americans are being born, in the middle of a desert in this huge dump site.
Journalist Chuck Bowden, never one to pull his punches. His article on illegal immigrants appears in Mother Jones Magazine. More when we come back here and now. And you write that most of the workers in New Orleans right now, working construction, rebuilding that city, are illegal immigrants. Tell us more about what you mean by these comparisons.
I mean, it's such a vast force that it's functionally unstoppable. The Mexican state of Zacatecas, for example, 50% of its citizens now live in the United States. You go into the back country of Mexico, there's no one there. They've all left. That this isn't what a lot of Americans think, a migration up here for seasonal labor. This is literally an exodus from a failing society. You find women out there carrying babies in the desert in the summer, and babes in arms. Well, people aren't doing that have any option. They're doing it because they have no option. So the only way you could stop illegal immigration, hypothetically, is make them unemployable here. And we all know that isn't going to happen, because we have industries here totally dependent on illegal labor. The hotel industry, the construction industry, the slaughterhouse industry, the restaurant industry. But if you wanted to fine employers $50,000 an hour, trust me, no illegal would be able to get a job.
We point out that even if it was possible to stop the tide of immigrants, that this would implode Mexico because you'd have incredible unrest in a country that doesn't have jobs.
That's right.
How do you change that situation? How does the U.S., because we've heard this from other people, the woman who wrote the terrific book about following children crossing the border, she said the same thing. Only way to change the flow of immigrants is to change the poverty in those countries. How do you do that?
It's going to take time. To start with, as we've learned in Iraq, it's not that easy to change someone else's government. Look, the cheapest way to do this and the best way is to have American investment in the places these people are coming from. Otherwise, they're going to come here. You don't have simple choices. You want to build a wall, as I say, and wall them out, fine. Then Mexico explodes, and you'll have a revolutionary state on a 2,000-mile border. I'll give you another part of the puzzle. If you say there's 12 million illegals here, we'll give you amnesty and put you on the pathway to citizenship, that would also destroy the Mexican economy, because we know from previous amnesties, as soon as people get that status, they stop sending money home. The $20 billion disappears.
Why do they do that?
They bring their families up once they get amnesty.
So they have no
and then there's nobody they have to send it to.
Right, right.
You know, we're between a rock and a hard place. What I wanted to do in the article was get a statement of reality if we're going to discuss this. Get rid of the nonsense that Middle Eastern terrorists are coming across the Rio Grande. That's not true. Get rid of the nonsense that these are just greedy Mexicans that want to live in El Norte. These are poor people trying to survive. And finally, get rid of the nonsense, which is going to blow up in people's faces eventually, that they're not affecting wages. Of course they are. They'll work for anything because they're desperate. You know, you can't lie to people that work in factories here and say that illegals are not affecting them. They are.
You paint one picture that stayed with me. It's when you went to Houston to cover the story of the evacuees from Hurricane Katrina, and you found yourself in a restaurant, one scene on one side of the counter, one scene on the other. Can you describe that?
Yeah, I walked into a restaurant, and it was obvious that everyone in the restaurant was a Katrina evacuee. It was an Italian bistro, and there were hundreds of them. They're all talking together, and they're all shell-shocked. And then I look, it had an open kitchen like bistros do these days, and everybody in there was a short, dark-looking Indian, you know, basically from Oaxaca or Chiapas. And you knew no matter what papers they had, the people working in the kitchen, they were bogus. You know, you can buy papers on the street. So you had one group of economic evacuees feeding another group who were hurricane evacuees. And, of course, what struck me was the Americans were essentially helpless at that point, whereas these people that were here illegally were thriving. They had created the new life. You know, they had experienced their own Katrina, as it were, and survived.
And the other thing that the image says, and you say it elsewhere in your article, is, you know, we couldn't even evacuate, you know, what, 100,000
people out of New Orleans. Yeah, I used to tell, you know, the joke in the bar, I used to tell people, if we really want to evacuate people from a city like New Orleans after a hurricane, we ought to hire these coyotes, because they're moving a million people a year with crummy vans, you know, illegally. But, see, what stuns me is when people talk about deportation. I mean, I don't think the American people are up for having police searching out 12 million men, women, and children, throwing them in boxcars and sending them back to Mexico.
Well, and again,
I don't think we have the stomach for it. I certainly don't.
And again, as you point out, if we couldn't get people out of New Orleans, 100,000, how are we going to get 12 million out of the U.S.?
No, that's what we have to do is bite the bullet, face reality, that we're going to have more of these people. There's millions of them, and we have to find out some way to create order out of chaos. Meaning people shouldn't be dying in my desert sneaking into the country illegally, because they're coming anyway. In my particular sector, the most transgressed sector in the United States, the Tucson sector, the Border Patrol admits that 92% of the people that try to enter the country illegally get through. You meet people from Central America and Southern Mexico that have traveled over 1,000 miles that are poor. They're not going back. You sit in a plaza in Mexico right on the border, and some guy will say, do you know where Tennessee is? Do you know where Oregon is? You know, they have this little address of some relative they're going toward. Mm. I mean, these are tough people. They work like the devil. Mexico's a fool, I think, to let these people leave.
And you're saying we either find a way to make their world better in Mexico or they will come to our better world.
It's not just them. I mean, this is a global phenomenon. It just happens the United States lives in a kind of isle of denial. except with Mexico. We're a first world country facing a third world nation. So we get a taste of what the rest of the planet's going through. And the planet's producing poor people faster than any other kind. These migrations are going on all over. The Europeans are trying to wall themselves off from Africa and so forth and so forth. So we're going to find out who we are by how we respond to it.
Chuck Boden's reflections on illegal immigration, along with the photos of Julian Cardona, appear in the September-October issue of Mother Jones. You can link to it by visiting our website, here-now.org. Chuck, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And you always know where you stand with Chuck. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide, mos.org/nctl. And Pegasystems, offering smart business process management software.
Many say they're relying on credit checks instead of just resumes because credit checks help determine whether an employee is reliable and responsible. And credit checks give information often left off a job application. Diane Lewis writes about the growing use of employee credit checks in today's Boston Globe, so we thought we'd give her a call and find out more. Diane, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with a primer for those who are saying, what exactly is that again? What exactly is a credit report? Who keeps it? What's in it?
The credit report is created when you first borrow money, when you apply for credit for a car, or you decide to go to college and you need a loan, or you get a Visa or a MasterCard to buy clothing.
We understand that a government act requires consumer reporting companies, three of them, to keep this rating and to provide you with a copy. What's in it?
Well, the three companies, first of all, that provide this information are Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. And essentially, what is in it is your credit score. And the score can range from 300 to 900. And it's based on your payment history. It's based on whether or not you have bankruptcies. It shows any outstanding debt. It's based on the length of time you've had credit. It's based on the number of inquiries on your report and also the type of credit you currently have. Do you have a loan? Do you have a credit card, et cetera?
So when you say a payment time, if you've had some late payments, that's going to detract from your score.
Yes, it will.
So how are prospective employers using credit ratings? What are they trying to learn?
If you've changed your name, if you have an alias, if you have had a bankruptcy, that would show up on your credit report. The number of employers you've had, their names and how they can be reached, that's available.
Whether you've been sued, whether you've been arrested,
yes.
It's all on there.
Yes. Employers say they want to gauge character and honesty as well as integrity. And in the past, banks, financial service companies, for example, were the ones who would use this to determine whether they can hire somebody to care for their money or to care for the money of other people. Now it's expanded. Retail employers are doing this. IT companies are doing this.
Is it legal? I mean, can they just go in and get someone else's credit rating?
No. In 2001, the law was changed, and essentially they have to ask permission. So they can give you a heads up. With the young woman I interviewed for the story, for example, she was working as a part-timer and was offered a full-time position with this company. And they came to her and said, you've passed everything. You know, we really want you. We have one last thing to do. We have to do a credit check.
Well, in that young woman's case, she gave permission, and what happened?
Well, she gave permission, and they came back and said, sorry. You have quite a few loans. Apparently, she had defaulted on some of her loans, and then she received a deferment. And a deferment is something that can help students get their loan paying back on track. But in her case, you know, she had already established the credit, and the payment history was already there.
And then she didn't get the job?
She did not get the job.
And what are companies saying? What is this telling them about people, that somebody might have defaulted or deferred?
they say that it reveals how responsible they are. I quoted one gentleman who says, if you can't organize your finances, then how can you hope to work for a company and organize the job that you're going to be doing?
Well, you know, what is the thinking then, Diane? Because we know more and more companies are doing this. But there are people who have extenuating circumstances.
Yes, there are.
Do companies ever take into consideration the fact that maybe you were in a recent divorce or inherited someone else's debt?
Some companies do. I interviewed a woman named Jacqueline O'Sullivan, for example. She works for IBM, and she said IBM was fabulous, that she got the job. And she immediately told the company, if you're going to do a credit check, I want you to know that my credit is not great because I went through a divorce, and after that I went to get an advanced degree, and I have a daughter. And the company understood, and the company said, don't worry about that. Now, she had problems when she was placed at another firm that she was doing some work on their computer systems, and they came up to her and said, sorry, we can't use you, and the reason is you have bad credit.
We're talking to Diane Lewis. She's business reporter for the Boston Globe. In fact, you can hear her in the newsroom right now, but can you improve your credit rating, or should you be upfront about it?
You should be upfront. You should, if you've been through a divorce or you have had serious illness or there is some extenuating circumstances, then you should just say so. The other thing you should do is be proactive. Call the companies up and develop a payment plan.
In other words, can you improve your credit rating?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. So you can call these companies up. You can say, look, I'm having a bad time right now, but I can pay $30 a week or $100 a month, whatever. Develop the payment plan, get those bills down, and that is one step towards rebuilding your credit. The other thing you can do, there is an organization called the American Student Assistance Corps. They will help students budget. They will help them to develop repayment options. So, for example, a deferment or a forbearance. Those are repayment options where they will set aside the loan for a while so that you can get yourself back on track. I think the forbearance is for those who are having severe financial difficulties because of illness or some other problem. So there are ways to correct and change your credit.
And by the way, you can get your credit report by law for free at least once a year. We'll link to the website where you can learn more about that. But I guess the last thought is that when you're looking into your credit report, beware of phony credit report companies.
Yes, and that actually is one of the reasons why some of the people I interviewed were pretty outraged, because they maintained, you know, that they had been the victims of identity theft. And so, you know, there was one individual who told me that he had suffered from identity theft. He had lost his wallet somewhere, and when he checked his credit report, there were some things on there that he did not incur those debts. But there is a national effort to spur legislation that would freeze consumers' credit reports, making it unavailable to a range of people and organizations, including employers. So far, I think about 7 states have passed this legislation. This legislation developed after Choice Point, Inc., a personal and financial data collection firm, reported that it had mistakenly sold the financial information of more than 145,000 people.
Diane Lewis again, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for speaking with us about credit checks.
Thank you.
And we just want to take a minute here to remind you that, as always, we love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town. Well, still to come, It's a Dog's Life, literally, in a new novel by Stupid Pet Tricks creator Meryl Marco. That's ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, have you noticed? Prices at the pump have dropped more than 30 cents a gallon over the last month, bringing gasoline prices to their lowest level since April of this year, and some experts think that may give a boost to the entire U.S. economy. Also, a consortium of oil companies announced today that they are very close to a major oil discovery in the U.S. Tests deep in the Gulf of Mexico, they say, have been very promising, and if they pan out, America's oil reserves could be increased by as much as 50%. Well, joining us with more on the oil scene, Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. And tell us first, Mark, about this possible discovery of a very large new oil reserve. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that it's not exactly going to usher in an era of plentiful cheap oil, but still, it seems like a big deal. Put it in perspective.
Yeah, I think it is a big deal. It will increase, as you said, the U.S. oil reserves by as much as 50%. It could be comparable in size to Alaska's Prudhoe Bay, so it is quite significant. And perhaps most importantly, it's symbolic of the effect higher prices has, and that is that entices energy companies to go out, explore, and develop, and ultimately produce more energy, and that's exactly what's happening.
And who owns this field?
Well, it's a consortium of energy companies that are going to develop it, Chevron being the lead energy company, but there are a couple other, including the Norwegian state-controlled oil company. So it's a consortium of companies that have come together and are working to get this up and running.
And before you line up with your bucket, though, we understand that just because they're exploring it doesn't mean, I mean, the first production might come till when, 2010?
Yeah, it's a ways off, and it's still uncertain. Another important thing about this is they're using very sophisticated new technology, that's another important aspect of this in that it suggests that when prices are high, energy companies are going to utilize and develop new technologies for developing energy, and ultimately that they'll reap benefits.
Well, and of course, in hearing you say that this is what oil companies say they do with their profits, they go out and explore for new oil, I can hear some people saying, oh, darn, and they found some because we were hoping they'd take that money and go find alternative energy.
Well, I think they're doing all of the above, but obviously we need lots of all kinds of energy, including traditional oil, natural gas, along with the alternative energy to make sure that we have plenty of energy in the future.
Well, and why are gas prices falling now? Because the drumbeat had been, you know, there's not enough oil to go around, especially as China and India kick in their use of oil. So why are prices falling?
Well, I think the energy prices and gasoline prices will stay high because of strong global demand. And as you point out, China and India are a big part of that. But at the moment, we are starting to see oil prices come down a bit. There hasn't been a major hurricane in the Gulf, and that's been very helpful. And because of the higher prices that we're now experiencing, we're getting more supply. That's evident in today's announcement. And also, growth in demand is slowing. You know, people respond to the higher prices by consuming less or consuming less aggressively. And finally, we're past the key summer driving season when we drive less and demand is lower and inventories are pretty ample. So all of that's conspired to bring prices down.
And remind us why this is so important. The former Fed Reserve, a former Federal Reserve economist says today that he thinks that the Fed will have to take falling prices into account in their fight against inflation. But we understand that gasoline purchase only counts for about 3% of consumer spending, so remind us why, you know, we're watching this so closely.
Well, falling gasoline prices are very helpful to consumers. It's like acts very much like a tax cut. And just to give you perspective, every penny drop in a gallon of gasoline puts about $1 billion in consumers' pocket over a year. So prices are down now almost 15 cents from their peak earlier in August. If they stay where they are, that would lower gas bills by about $15 billion, and most of us would spend it, and it would be helpful to supporting growth.
Right. And Mark Zandi, about a minute left, but we want to get in that we understand that BP's Alaska stream of oil may be fuller sooner than the original date. Remember the story of the corrosion in the pipes there, but apparently it's less than they thought.
Yeah, that's correct. Good news there as well. That could have been a very significant problem, in fact, if the corrosion was substantive and caused production to be curtailed. But looks like it's less of a problem.
So some good news today. Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com. Mark, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, including Meryl Marco. That's Here and Now. Thank you. Her new novel is Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. Any dog lover will recognize that as the preferred bedtime technique of their pooches, but it also becomes metaphor for Meryl's heroine, Dawn, who wanders aimlessly from bad relationship to worse. As the book opens, Dawn Tarnower is trying to figure out why Paxton, her latest boyfriend, walked out on her. She gets an answer from an unexpected source, her pit bull mix, Chuck.
Chuck stared at me, his eyes locked into mine. "Come on, you must have at least suspected there was someone else," he said. "Couldn't you smell her on his pants?" My crying stopped abruptly as I stared down at him. His mouth wasn't moving, so why did I think he had spoken? Was it the early morning drinking? Now I sat watching breathlessly as Chuck got up and walked to the other side of the room, picked up a filthy tennis ball in his mouth, then trotted back to wordlessly deposit it in my lap. "Here, throw this," he said. "It'll make you feel better."
That's Meryl Marco reading from her new book, Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. And Meryl joins us from KQED in San Francisco with more. Meryl, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm better now. I laughed out loud through this book. We know you have, you know, sort of a fondness for animals because didn't you come up with the stupid pet tricks idea on the David Letterman show?
I did. That was one of my brilliant contributions to American society.
And so you have this fondness for dogs, but have you always put, you know, balloons of words over their heads?
You know, I started doing it a lot of years ago when I used to have a magazine column. One thing about living with animals, they're so endearing and they're so great and I enjoy them so much, but they really are like having exchange students from Neptune. They're just living in a different reality than the one you're in. And I sort of like to try to figure it out on their terms.
Well, that's what you do that's so different. I mean, others have put words into dogs' mouths or thought bubbles above their heads, but they make them human words, human conversations. Chuck speaks as a dog. He turns to Dawn at one point and said, "I've been meaning to ask you about that water coming down the face thing," which is when she cries all the time. What are some other things you can think of?
Why don't you strew garbage around? Like that's when I leave the house, that's the first thing my dog does. I once put a videotape camera on him and then snuck out like a lot of people do and just got the biggest laugh after watching him wait and listen to my steps and listen to the gate close and then get up on the counter and move from place to place scavenging stuff. And as soon as he heard my footsteps come again, you know, back sitting on the floor looking like he didn't do anything.
Let's go to that passage on page 116 where Chuck, you know, he's very curious and now he has a chance to talk to Dawn through some, you know, who knows why. And he asks her, "Why do you not strew your garbage around?" And she says, "Well, the word garbage means discarded waste. It's meant to be thrown out. It rots, stinks, and gets maggots." Read his response, please.
"So since we agree there's no downside at all," he said, "why not roll on it first? When I'm flinging a coffee filter full of coffee grounds, sometimes for a second it's 30 million years ago. There I am ripping up the intestines of some 1,500-pound Phoboromus pattersoni. Now that was a rodent. And I'm so into hurling those guts around, well, I do it every day, except I know it pisses you off."
We learn so much about who Chuck is. I mean, Chuck's an animal.
Well, I figure that a lot of, at least this is what I'm observing on my dogs, a lot of what they're doing, they would never dream of doing, except for that they want to please you. They like you so much, and they're trying to get along with you. But, for instance, my dog Puppy Boy is, I think of him as a self-punishing shepherd because he knows what he's not supposed to be doing based on my rules. He does it anyway. And then when you walk in the room, he lets you know that he's beating himself up about it. He puts his tail between his legs and he sits in the corner, as flattens himself to the ground as low as he can go. And he just lets you know, you don't need to punish me. I am hurting myself more than you could ever hurt me. So that to me is just hilarious that he's bothering to do that, knowing that as soon as I leave, he's going to do it again.
And they have this unbelievable switch that flips their moods. That's illustrated when Dawn's dad comes to the door at one point. And if we could, I think we have to sort of edit this passage. Chuck speaks his mind, and sometimes his mind is in the gutter. But if we could just read a little bit about, you know, their dual reaction to someone being at the door.
"Hey, get away from the door, you miserable freak," I heard Chuck shout at my dad. "I'll rip your butt in half." "Me too, I'll rip your butt in half too," yelled Johnny Depp. "We hate you, we hate you, we hate you, we hate you." "You guys, knock it off," I said, racing to the door. "I just told you, it's my dad." "Hi, dad," I said, hugging him. "Come on in, it's great to see you," screamed Chuck. "Thank God you're finally here," yelled Johnny Depp. "We missed you. Where have you been? Welcome back. Who are you?"
Who are you? I mean, that captures so perfectly. perfectly how a dog can change its mood to please
you.
Well,
I had a dog named Lewis, who I still miss. He died not so long ago, but he was my favorite dog I've ever had. And he had what I refer to as a greeting disorder, which is that when you come in the door, he would just greet you to almost the point of injuries. And that just always made me laugh. It was like he was so excited that you were there that I always thought if he was a singer-songwriter, his best song would be called "I'll Never Stop Saying Hello." He would just say hello and say hello and say hello. And then if you went out the door and you came back a second later, he'd start it all over again.
At one point, Dawn sort of sums up, you know, why it is that she's going to choose her dogs over, you know, some of these worthless guys. And it seems like she's really just understanding. What is that thing? What is that thing about dogs that she realized and that obviously you feel?
Well, I think all animals are just, well, certainly mainly dogs, naive good intentions. They don't always do things that make any sense, and that's the funny part of them. They've got instincts that tell them to do things that don't even apply to the lives that they're living now. Still, they mean well, and they like us so much. It's so touching to have creatures like you that much. They like you better than any people ever like you. You know, people are always very conditional in the way they like you, but dogs just are crazy about you.
Would you really want to have, I mean, I you mentioned having lost a dog, and I have too, and I'm saying that, you know, I say I would love to talk to my dog or have my dog talk to me, but oh my gosh, I can't imagine it being even harder than it already is.
Right. You know, that's what I've often thought about that, too. And I also think it's a question of be careful what you wish for, because I think they'd have a lot of, if they really could articulate, a lot of grotesque things to say, because their interests are not the same as our interests. It's not poetry that they're interested in. It's excrement. So, and you gotta, you know, that's one thing about loving animals. You gotta buy that. That's part of it. You know, yeah. Part of it is weird things like they throw up a lot.
And they don't
mind. Children.
Right. We've been speaking with Meryl Marco. Her new book is Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. And by the way, I think it was the dog named Johnny Depp that,
right.
Explained.
Is, that probably, that distinction needs to be made.
That it was a dog. But yeah. The dog Johnny Depp explained why he walked in circles before lying down.
Yeah, I have him saying, well, I'm tamping down the leaves and twigs. And she says, but it's my bed. There are no leaves and twigs. And he goes, well, did it ever occur to you? Maybe that's why.
Because he's tamped them down.
Oh. It's the same as that little feet flinging thing they do after they poop. You know, that little backwards kick. And you just go, I'm sure this had a real function in nature at some point. At this point, I can't even imagine what it is.
Meryl, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk.
I Want a Dog by the Pet Shop Boys in honor of the late, great Chihuahua Moe. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. First grade, it's tougher than you think. Also, the punk rock band Mission of Burma, 19 years ago they broke up. Some went to 9-to-5 jobs, now they're back. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.